I'm turning on the tape recorder for lesson number 8. Lynn told me to say this was lesson number 8. Last week I forgot to turn it on and I caught no manner of H-E-double-L about it. And so I came in this morning and I have 3 of these sticky notes on bright pink saying record, record, record. And a couple of other people, I won't say who, have accosted me this morning. So anyway, I'm sorry. I forgot to turn it on last week. We're going to do just a quick review in a minute. A couple of notes about worship. I really loved Lydia's opening prelude because to me it was kind of reflective of wandering. It had a very wandering tone, the wandering through the wilderness and coming into the promised land and being settled but still divided up into tribes. So I really loved that prelude. And then she had that little coda at the end of the service that kind of reflected the place we are in the story as we come to the Kings today. And so that was, I thought that was very good. And of course, Tim's sermon about entering into God's rest. And I was thinking that it's not entering into our rest, what we think rest is, it's God's rest. That whole relational thing. We have to be in line with what God wants to enter God's rest instead of just what our idea of rest is. So enough of the comments about the worship this morning. We have 3 things to do this morning. We're going to jump on the train and go as fast as we can to catch up. We had a great discussion last week about holy war and what a wonderful thing holy war is. Not. I wore my peace suspenders today because I felt like after thinking about God commanding holy war, I had to show a visual to counteract that, about God's vision of peace. And so we need to get caught up now, continue to finish getting the conquest and the settlement into the promised land of Canaan. Then we need to look briefly at the judges, which we were supposed to look at last week and never even got to. And then today we're supposed to be looking at the king. So I'm hoping we at least get started on the time of kings, and next week we'll continue to look at kings and prophets. So we're going to jump right into the conquest. And we started last week looking at the story of Rahab, the prostitute, and the spies, and her sheltering the spies and making a treaty with them to take care of her house when they came in and took over Jericho in the Holy War. And then we got off to Holy War, and we never got further than that. So, just quickly to go through the rest of the events in the book of Joshua in the conquest as they enter the Promised Land. Of course, there's the crossing of the Jordan River, and we heard in our children's sermon this morning a good recap of that. And there were the 12 priests, the Levites, who went into the river and stood in the river and had 12 stones, and the water parted like what earlier story? The Red Sea. So we have an echo of the Red Sea and God's action in leading people through to the Promised Land. And for those scientists among us, there is evidence of several earthquakes in the area that have made landslides that dammed up the Jordan River. So, but this is a theological view of what may have happened geographically, but they saw God's action in that at that opportune time to lead people, deliver people into the Promised Land. And so then the priests set up the 12 stones on the other side as a memorial. The word is at Gilgal, which in Hebrew means circle. So a circle of stones to remember, to remind people of God's action in leading them into the land of promise. I like Janet's reference to her mantle of cards this morning. We all set up memorials. We set up things to remind us of God's presence and God's action in our life. And that comes up over and over again with the Hebrews setting up stones here and there and a number of places. And they're teaching tools, they're reminders that God has been at work. In Gilgal, this circle of stones. Then Joshua has this vision of an angel with a sword. And Joshua is what do we say? Fear, anger, and suspicion. Joshua is worried about the enemies and worried about what this angel with the sword is. And he says, whose side are you on? And are you on God's side? Are you on our side, God's side, or are you on the side of the Canaanites who are our enemies? And the angel says, I am God's commander. Doesn't say one side or the other. I'm God's commander. It reminded me of if we claim God is on our side. Interesting. It reminded me of the quotation from Abraham Lincoln. In the great contest, each party claims to act in accordance with the will of God.
Can't read my writing. One must be wrong. Sir, my concern is not whether God is on our side. My concern is to be on God's side, for God is always right. So Abraham Lincoln, even in the Civil War, was aware that simply to claim that we're on God's side, we may be mistaken. This vision of the angel who says, I'm not necessarily on your side or their side, I'm on God's side, and that we need to focus on following God and doing what God says is right. So the interesting vision of the angel with the sword. Then we have the fall of Jericho, and you remember the story where they marched around the city of Jericho how many days? Seven days. I gave you the answer. Open book test. And so they marched around the seventh day. On the seventh day, they marched around the city seven times on the seventh day, and they blew trumpets, and then there was the shout at Joshua's command, and the walls came tumbling down. Joshua hit the battle of Jericho, Jericho, Jericho. Joshua hit the battle of Jericho, and the walls came tumbling down. Okay, so we all know that story. And again, God's action. Interesting, the shout. There's some evidence that the term Yahweh is rooted way back in a shout, Yah! That may have been a warrior shout. Yahoo! Yippee! Yah, which becomes Yahweh, and there's all kind of different aspects of Yahweh. We've talked about the ground of being, I am who I am. But that early in its beginnings, it was a shout of praise and following Yahweh as the leader. So interesting, over and over, the shout comes up, and the term Hallelujah is praise Yahweh. And it's a shout. You say, Hallelujah! Can we say that? Hallelujah, hallelujah, brothers and sisters. All right. So, faith, thank you. Faith is not just an intellectual thing. It's a visceral thing. It involves your body and your emotion and your mind and everything, giving yourself to God. So, all that's kind of caught up in Yahweh and the shout at the Battle of Jericho and the shout over and over again. So, I digress. There's a whole sermon in that. So Jericho falls, and then there's that dictum of God that it should be completely razed and burned, the holy war dictum we spent time on last week. And so they do that, except for Achan, who disobeys and takes some booty. It looks awfully glittery and shiny to him, and he decides to keep some of it. And so then he's called on the carpet and chastised for his disobedience. And Joshua says that there will be consequences for the disobedience, not following, not obeying, not following the command of God. We're going to see that come up again with King Saul when he does a very similar thing and disobeys and doesn't carry out a complete holy war destroying everything, but keeps back part of it to sacrifice to God, but still it's in disobedience. And there are consequences for Saul. But here you have that happening earlier with Jericho. And so the next battle, they go to fight the town of Ai, or Ai, or Ai. Ai. And they lose the battle because of the disobedience. They lose the next battle. They're all confident that Yahweh is on their side, and the Ark of the Covenant is leading them into battle, so it symbolizes God's presence, and yet they lose at Ai as a result of that disobedience. The term Ai in Hebrew means ruin. So because of their disobedience, they have experienced ruin in their continued effort to inhabit the land. But then they reconnoiter and they start out again. God forgives them. They get on the road again, and they hatch a plan to create an ambush in which part of the forces go around the other side of Ai, and then the other part comes forward and lures the Canaanites out of the city, and then the ones who've gone behind Ai come and take them over, and so they finally conquer Ai. And so you have this continuing of the conquest of the land. At that point, there's another interesting sermon in there. You remember back in the Abraham story, it says Abraham came to the promised land, a land not knowing but where God was leading, and he set up his first altar between Bethel and Ai. Bethel means house of God. Ai means ruin. There's a sermon in that. as we travel with God and we set up our altar, are we going to be in the house of God, or are we going to follow our own ways into the place of ruin? Very kind of symbolic, the names. Those names, that site of the altar comes up several times throughout the story between Bethel and Ai, between God's house and ruin. Good. There's a sermon in there. Let's tell Tim about it. Maybe he'll preach it. Okay, then Joshua establishes a covenant renewal ceremony in which he reminds people of the covenant that they need to be obedient, the Ten Commandments, the covenant, the promise to be God's people, and God will be their God at Shechem. Shechem's an important place. There are two mountains, Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim, and they make new stone tablets there, set up another stone memorial to remind people of the covenant, and those two mountains kind of symbolizes the two tablets of the covenant of the Ten Commandments. In the New Testament, before that, in the civil war between the North and the South and the separation of the two states, this became the holy shrine of the North in Shechem, Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim, and Jerusalem, Mount Zion in the South in Judah was their site of the temple and worship. So this is kind of the alternate, becomes sort of an alternate place of worship later in history. And in the time of Jesus, Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim are the site of worship of the Samaritans. The Samaritans, who've intermixed and are now looked down on by the Jews, have an alternate place from Jerusalem and Mount Zion. They continue to worship at Mount Ebal and Gerizim at Shechem, which is where Jesus met the woman at the well. So a lot of the symbolism and the power of this place is very important. And it's here, in the first instance, it's the place to renew the covenant with God. Then there's a Gibeonite deception in which these foreigners, the Gibeonites, they get afraid of the power of the Ark of the Covenant and the Israelites, and so they tear their clothes and they put dirt on themselves and they get moldy food and water, and they come to the Israelites and say, "Oh, we're foreigners, we've been traveling all this way, and make a treaty with us and protect us." And so Joshua says, "Okay," and he makes this treaty, which is he doesn't realize that they're actually enemies. And so that's a violation of the holy war to make a treaty. And so then after Joshua finds out about it, he says, "You're cursed to be slaves." And later on, they become servants in the temple. If you read later in the story of the temple, the Gibeonites are the servants, the acolytes in the temple. So that kind of gets carried out. But then Joshua does protect them, and there's an attack, and Joshua fights off the attack that's attempting to kill the Gibeonites, and that's the famous story where the sun and the moon stand still to give a longer period of time to fight off the enemies and save the Gibeonites. So it's interesting, even though they're punished and they've entered into this treaty under false pretenses, still Joshua protects them, and we have this interesting story about the sun and moon standing still. Then there's a series of other battles, and they divide up the territory between the different tribes. There's a map that's kind of fuzzy that Tim gave us that kind of shows where the different tribal divisions were in the Promised Land. And they set aside two things. They set aside six cities of refuge. Interesting, all this war and killing, and yet in the midst of it, they say, we need to set aside six cities that will protect people who may be falsely accused to make sure justice is done. You know, if there's an accidental death, instead of executing them, they have a place where they can have refuge until the proper procedure, everybody has a right to a fair trial, the proper procedure is followed to carry out justice. So it's interesting, in all this climate of holy war and killing everybody, you have this little glimmer of protection and hope in the cities of refuge. And then there are cities set aside for the Levites, because the Levites were what was their job?
Priests.
They were the priests, so they didn't get a piece of territory like the other tribes. They were spread out, and four cities from each of the other tribes was set aside for the Levites to be Levitical cities. So that's all part that happens here in the division of the territory. Joshua gives a farewell speech in which he says, make sure you stay on the path of Yahweh. Turn neither to the right nor to the left. Don't turn to foreign gods, either to the left or to the right. An interesting message for us in our political climate today, huh? Neither to the extreme right nor to the extreme left. We have a proclivity one direction or the other, but like the vision of the angel, seek to be on God's side, following God's way, instead of being swayed by foreign gods, by fears, by greed, off to the right or to the left. Interesting. There's a sermon in that passage. And then there's interesting, immediately after Joshua says, don't go to the right or the left and stay true, the three tribes that settle in the Transjordan, that's to the east of the Jordan River over here, they set up an alternate altar. And they're not supposed to have a separate altar. And so there's this big squabble in which the other nine tribes get mad. Hey, you can't set up another altar. There's a big squabble, and the tribes on the Transjordan say, oh, wait, no, this isn't. This is just to remind us of the true God. We're not worshiping another God here. So that all kind of gets settled. But it's interesting that, immediately after saying, stay true to the one God, you have this squabble over an alternate altar being set up. So you see the back and forth. These are some of the key changes that Tim was talking about. That's a great metaphor to use as you go from major to minor to major to minor key in this up and down journey of God's people entering into the promised land. And then we have a more detailed account of the covenant renewal, and we had that as our memory verse this morning. Don't worship the gods beyond the river, back up there in the Euphrates where Abraham and Sarah came from. Adam and Eve too, for that matter. Abraham and Sarah. The gods that some of our ancestors worshipped beyond the Nile in Egypt, and when they weren't really true to Yahweh. Or the gods in this land, the Canaanite gods, choose whom you're going to serve. As for me and my house, we will serve Yahweh, the God, the one true God. So again, this covenant renewal, this kind of spelled out in those powerful words in Joshua's final speech. It's this covenant renewal, but in the telling of the story, it's filled out at the end of Joshua. So that's our quick move through the conquest. And I put up here again some of the things I said last week about how we deal with the difficult issue of holy war and the way the story is presented. Remember, this is not researched factual history. It's theology. It's a story told through a particular eye. So it's, for one thing, use the Bible to interpret the Bible. Look at the whole Bible we talked about last week. Look at the prophetic vision, which is a corrective to some of the other things said in the Bible. Look at the prophetic vision in the Old Testament. Look at the gospel in Jesus Christ in the New Testament to try to help make sense or understand how these seemingly terrible passages fit in with the whole story and the whole trajectory, the arc of the story toward which God is moving people, toward salvation, toward God's rest, as Tim said this morning. God's shalom, God's peace and justice and faithfulness. So how does the story fit in with the whole story? And then realizing this is God's story of love, creation, redemption when people fall into sin, but it's also a human story, a story of faith by human people who have flawed eyes. And, you know, we said, Elfrida said last week, the victors write the history. The story is written from the perspective of weak human beings. So you have to try to say, where is God's movement in this story, which is both God's story, but also a very human story of faith and understanding and misunderstanding sometimes. So that's just kind of my way of thinking how to deal with some of these difficult passages. And like Jacob, we're wrestling with God's word, and we come out with a limp, but we wrestle a blessing out of it. And you know, it's a powerful struggle sometimes. And I put up there Hebrews 4, God's word is living and true, like a two-edged sword that separates bone from marrow, joint from marrow. It's not a static thing. Oh, this is the way it was. Let's just follow it. Just like, no, we have to be engaged with it. It's a living word that we engage with, we wrestle with like Jacob, to discern God's truth for us and for our time. So that's kind of a summary of some of the points I try to keep in mind as I wrestle with difficult passages. Okay, we've gotten into the promised land, and now we're going to take about 10 minutes to look at Judges. I'm trying to keep an eye on the clock today. And then we'll get to the Kings. So, the Judges do follow a chronological sequence, but each one of their stories is kind of self-contained. And in this time, as they're living as tribes, what scholars call the tribal amphictyony. There's a $5 word for you. Say amphictyony. I can't even say amphictyony. Amphictyony. So the 12 tribes are independent of each other, and yet sometimes they come together. I kind of think of maybe before the United States, you had the 12 colonies, which sometimes worked together and sometimes were at odds with each other. Or Native Americans, who were tribes. They weren't a united Native American nation. There were different tribes, different Native American nations. But then sometimes some of those would come together to fight off an enemy. But they were really loose and independent. So that's kind of the way things were. There was a sense of unity as all as Israelites, and yet they were operating independently as the 12 different tribes. And so during this time, God would, in this wandering music of the time, God would raise up leaders to lead in a particular crisis, and that leader was called a judge. And that leader would lead for a time, and they would be faithful for a time, and then they would fall back into idolatry, back away from God. And then another judge would be raised up, and as the story is told, they're usually in periods of 40 years, increments of 40, which is, you know, again, it's not just that each one was exactly 40 years. That's a symbolic number. The 40 years that comes up, the 40 years of the wilderness, and wandering in the wilderness, 40 years of Moses on Mount Sinai, 40 days of Moses on Mount Sinai. So 40 is kind of a symbolic of a generation has passed. And so these kind of come in increments of 40. So let's just name some of the judges that we can think of. This is your job. What are some of the judges that you know about?
Samson.
Deborah.
Gideon.
Othniel. I think he was the first one.
Take it for the seminary trained minister here to remember Othniel. Which means something about God. I don't know what, but you remember when you see El on there, that's God. So it's something about God, but I didn't look that one up. Others?
Jephthah.
Yeah, not one of your more stellar characters.
Abimelech.
And interesting, Ab in Hebrew is father, as in Abba, father. Ab, Melech is ruler. So, father is ruler. Yes, it's interesting to me to look at the meaning of names. Abimelech is one of... somebody's sons, is it Gideon? One of Gideon's sons. But by a concubine. And he kills the 70 legitimate sons. Another not very stellar judge, Abimelech. Others? Samuel. Samuel's the last one. And really probably the greatest. I misspelled it. And it was U-E in it. Look at my notes to see if there's any we're missing. I think we've got most of them.
Jephthah.
Oh, we've got Jephthah.
Oh, yeah.
And there's one more we didn't mention. Ehud. Okay. So these are famous judges. And like I say, they raised up there. they're sort of heroes in a sense, and they bring wisdom, but they're all very flawed. They all have big clay feet, some of them more than others. We remember the story of Samson. What do you remember about Samson? Delilah. You remember Delilah about Samson. Yeah. He was a Nazarite, devoted to God, and so it, which means he can't cut his hair, so his hair is long. And he had a Philistine wife first, and that was kind of a messy situation. And then he finally marries Delilah, and she wants to find out, the Philistines want to find out the secret to his strength, so he goes through these series of things that he tells her is the secret of his strength, which really aren't. He says, well, if you tie my hair with 7 bowstrings, then I'll be helpless. And so she does that, but then he wakes up and just pops them loose. So that's not the secret. And then if you weave the 7, I think he was the first guy with dreadlocks. Says he has 7 locks of hair. So I don't know if he braided those like Rastafarians or anyway. If you weave those together with a pin, that'll take away my strength. Well, he wakes up. She does this when he's asleep, and then he just breaks the pen loose. So he goes through a series of these, and finally she says, she snags him. You don't love me. You keep giving me these false answers. You know, if you really love me, you can almost hear the tone of voice. So he tells her the secret, that it's in his hair, that if the locks of hair get cut off, then his strength will be gone, and of course, she then cuts them off in the night, and his strength is gone, and he's captured. And what do the Philistines do to him? They gouge out his eyes, and another gory story. And so he's put in prison, and then there's a big festival to celebrate Dagon, their king, and they bring him out for entertainment to dance before them, and he says, well, I can't see. To steady myself, put my hands on the pillars where his hair's grown back. And he prays, Lord, give me my strength one more time. And God does. Pulls down the temple, kills himself, and kills more people than he's killed earlier in his life as a judge. So a very dramatic story. There are a number of hero stories about Samson where he kills a lion, and then the bees come and put honey in it. He scoops out the honey and makes a little riddle out of that. So a lot of hero stories about Samson, but a flawed person, but raised up at that particular time. We need to move on probably to the kings. A couple of other ones. Deborah, of course, a woman, kind of an alternate female story here, a woman leader who then gets Barak, not Barack Obama, but Barak, who is her general to fight Sisera, the enemy. And then it's fairly long treatment of Deborah, and there's a narrative. In most of these, they're like two traditions, two stories. We've talked before in the Pentateuch, and now this is true in the Judges too. Two stories that kind of get woven together, like Samson's lock of hair. And so there's a narrative story, and then there's the Song of Deborah, in which she sings about what's happened, and it includes some very interesting things that aren't included in the narrative, some of which don't exactly coincide with each other, but you get these two strands, these two traditions about this hero judge Deborah, a woman, in which Sisera is led in the song. It says how he's led into the wadi of Kishon in the valley. What's a wadi? It's a dry creek bed. Yeah, it's a riverbed, but it's dry most of the year except when the rains come and then it's flooded with water. So Sisera comes in with his iron chariots, and the Israelites didn't have iron. The Philistines were advanced, and they had iron, and the dreaded iron chariots as a weapon of war goes into the wadi, and then a big thunderstorm comes, and God thunders out, and the rains come. Well, then the wadi turns into mud, and the heavy iron chariots get stuck in the mud. Where have we heard this story before? It's kind of a repeat, a retelling in a different situation now of the chariots of Pharaoh who get stuck in the mud in the Red Sea, and then they can't move, and so the soldiers have to get out of the chariots, and they're helpless against the infantry of the Israelites. And so the general Barak sweeps in and destroys Sisera's soldiers. It's interesting because it's really kind of an echo of the Red Sea story and the delivery from Pharaoh's chariots. Then there's that great interesting episode of how as Sisera is fleeing, he holds up in the camp of Jael, who he expects to protect him and to give him hiding, and she says she will, gives him milk, covers him with a blanket, and then she gets a tent peg and drives it through the temple of his head and kills Sisera. It was part of the duty of women to set up camp with the tents. I found that out in my research, much as Bedouins even today. It's the woman's job to drive the tent stakes around and set up the tents while the men are tending to the herds. So, you know, this fits with her role, but she uses that to... You like that, don't you, Alfreda?
It's always the same story.
Always the same story over and over.
It never changes.
Yes. Got the same story. And these stories really kind of retell the same process of in lots of different ways. But the overall process is major mode, God bringing forth a judge. Minor mode, people fall into idolatry and waywardness, and there's consequences. And then God raises up another judge, and then they fall into corruption again. So, same story told over and over. Red Sea, the Wadi of Kishon, the Jordan River parting. The same story, which all has to do with God's continued action through the journey of the Israelites and through the journey of our lives. Jephthah, the awful story of Jephthah rashly making a promise after victory that he's going to sacrifice the first thing that comes out of his house when he gets home, expecting it to be a servant. And it's his daughter. She's dancing and singing with a tambour, happy that her father's won the victory, but he's made the vow. And this is one of those texts of terror. She says, "You can't break your vow, Dad. You have to kill me." She is complicit in the story. It paints her as being complicit in his carrying out the vow to kill her. So there are a number of what I've referred to before. There's a book called Texts of Terror, and women are always the victims. Women there are other people that are victims too, but often women are the ones who are complicit in the submissive role. Remember, submissiveness is a result of the fall, way back in the story of the garden. Submissiveness is not what God wants, but you see that get played out in terrible ways in stories like the story of Jephthah. An awful story, but it shows the importance they placed on making promises and vows, that when you make a promise, it has consequences, terrible consequences sometimes, and the danger of bargaining with God. Oh, God, if you do this, you know, if you give me this victory, I'm going to give you the first thing that comes, bargaining, and the next thing you know, you've worked yourself into a terrible situation. Well, let's move on to Samuel and get to the king. Interesting stories full of thorns and brambles and difficulties to deal with and to remember these things about, but also of God's action in trying to bring leadership to people that want to go after the foreign gods, to prostitute themselves with foreign gods and get off the track of the covenant. The themes: God is the one who should be the king, should be in control, and you need to stay clear with God. Covenant is central. Remember the covenant. Remember that you need to be obedient and faithful. And if you don't, there's terrible consequences. Idolatry is verboten, to introduce a German word. In all of these, when people fall away to foreign gods, then come the terrible consequences. And that teaching is vital, the setting up of the stones at the crossing of the river. Over and over you have these memorials set up. The Ark of the Covenant is kind of a teaching tool. It goes with them and it reminds them of the covenant. It's the Ark of the Covenant, the Ten Commandments. The stones of the Ten Commandments are in the Ark of the Covenant. So you need to teach future generations. That's another theme that comes up over and over in these stories, is how the importance of teaching people about the covenant and about being faithful to Yahweh. With that, so if you want to read some of those interesting stories, say a prayer and read some of these great stories of the great and troubling stories of the flawed heroes of God, the judges.
So now we're going to come to Kings. The last great judge is Samuel.
And he's kind of a transitional figure. He's the last judge, but he's also a priest, acts as a priest, and as a prophet.
So it's interesting, the kind of the three marks of leadership of Jesus, and three ways of describing the work of ministers is to be prophet, priest, and king, ruler, judge. So that kind of corresponds. This is the intermediary, the one who helps people in their relationship with God, the priest. The prophet is the one who speaks God's word and keeps people true to the covenant. And the king or the judge is the one, the role of kingship and judge is to be a servant of the people, to serve them, to help them, to lead them, give them leadership. So in Samuel, you see these three elements brought together in a way that was not true of the previous judges. He functions in these all three of these roles. In Samuel, again, you have two different traditions woven together. In one of the traditions, Samuel is presented more as a wise seer, a kind of a local leader who people go to get advice. And then in another tradition, Samuel is more the judge and the prophet of all Israel. And in one of the traditions, you see God using Samuel to raise up a king, a new approach, a new strategy. The judges haven't worked. People continue to fall into corruption. So what, it's like you can imagine God thinking, what's the next strategy that I can try to bring people back to my way? You know, I made creation, then I tried starting over with wiping the slate clean with the flood, and then people went into corruption again. Then I tried a new approach of choosing one family, Abraham and Sarah and their family, to be a chosen race, to be a light to the nations. And then they went into slavery, and then I brought up Moses and a new kind of covenant with the Ten Commandments, and I led them through the wilderness of the promised land. Then I tried judges, still fall back into corruption. So it's almost like, what's the next strategy? You know, God as trial and error. About what can I do to bring people back to my way of shalom, of salvation, of peace, to my rest. And so, I lost my train of thought there. So now we come to the idea. So one of the traditions of Samuel is that God, through Samuel, is going to now raise up a king to unite the tribes, and this is a new approach. The other tradition of Samuel is God doesn't want a king. God is opposed to kingship because that might lead people in the wrong direction. So it's very interesting. You have these two traditions that kind of get woven together in the story. And the overall kind of sense you get from the story is that kingship might be a way to become a light to the nations more fully, but kingship is fraught with all kind of dangers. When you get one leader with a lot of power, it's fraught with all kind of dangers and difficulties. So that's kind of the underlying message in this. So we begin with the story of... find my place in my notes here. The call of Samuel. And you have his parents, Elkanah, and what's his mother's name?
Hannah.
That's right. And what's wrong with Hannah? She's barren. Another one of those things that comes up. Oh, Samson's mother was barren. Didn't say that in the story. Before God blesses her, and then Samson is born, and she dedicates him as a Nazarite because God has answered, Yahweh has answered her prayer, and he becomes a great judge. You know, I think the Samson stories are the there are more stories about Samson than any of the other judges. So, barrenness. You know, Sarah was barren. Rachel was barren. Samson's mother was barren. Hannah is barren. Again, symbolic of the barrenness of Israel when they keep falling back into idolatry and corruption. They've become barren. And so God has to act to bring new hope and new life. So Hannah is, she's, you know, there's another wife, Peninnah. And Peninnah has kids. Hannah doesn't. Peninnah teases Hannah for not having any kids. Elkanah loves Hannah more than he likes Peninnah, and so he gives her extra portions of food. That makes Peninnah mad. So she teases Hannah, and Hannah's beside herself. She goes to the shrine at Shiloh and prays in the temple. And she's praying there, mumbling with her mouth, you know, with her eyes shut, and her mumbling. And the priest, whose name is Eli, thank you, which Eli, El, God, Eli, thinks she's drunk. And he chastises her for being drunk. And she says, no, I'm honestly praying, I'm barren. And so then Eli hears, realizes she's sincere, and he blesses her. And one thing I discovered in reading about this, blessing is not simply go in peace. Blessing in the Hebrew understanding is that you are promising to stand with the other person and give of your resources for their well-being. It's a commitment of yourself for the well-being of the other person. So even when you go back to Abraham and Sarah, when they're blessed to be a blessing, it's not simply a prayer of blessing. It's to bless you is to say, and now I'm going to stand with you. You know, when we do a baby blessing in church and we have the church make a vow, we will do everything we can to support these parents in the upraising of this child in a Christian home. The church is promising, we're not just saying, God bless you, child, and then forget about it. We're promising to give of ourselves, to stand with that child and that family. And that's what blessing is about. That's the Hebrew understanding, the kind of deeper understanding of blessing. So that's an interesting thing to kind of understand about this. Eli blesses Hannah, and so then she conceives and gives birth. And she's promised to God, if you make me fertile and give me a child, I'll devote him to you. And so she does. And then later, she goes back to the temple after she's weaned, after Samuel was born. And she goes back to the temple after he's weaned. And so then she gets him to be a servant, a helper in the temple. And so he's there in the temple as a boy. And then there's a famous story of his hearing the call from God when he's asleep and he's kind of tending the light at night so the light doesn't go out. You know, I think of Catholic churches where they have the light. If the host is present for the Eucharist, you know, they always keep an eternal light burning. So they had this light burning, and Samuel's job was to make sure the light didn't go out. And so he's sleeping and watching the light, and so he hears the voice. He thinks it's Eli, and he runs to Eli. Eli says, don't wake me up. I want me. You're dreaming. Goes back. Finally, the third time, the Trinitarian time, the third time, Eli realizes, wait a minute, maybe he's hearing God. So he says, next time you hear the voice, say, speak, Lord, for your servant is listening. And he does, and that's God's call to Samuel to be the next judge. In the role in the temple, he's kind of already acting as a priest, as a priest's assistant. Again, the two stories. One of the stories has him being part of a clan of Zuphites, but another genealogy says he's part of the Levite clan, the priestly clan. So here you have him acting in the temple as part of the priestly clan, helping Eli in his priestly services. And here you already see he's doing the job of mediating, helping people in their connection, helping the Israelites in their connection with God. So he's called. An interesting set of stories there with Hannah. And then he comes into leadership as the judge, and there are some battles that are fought, and the Israelites start treating the Ark of the Covenant kind of like a magical
emblem that thinks, oh, well, we've got the Ark of the Covenant, so we're going to win the battles all the time. And so they go into this battle all cocky and self-confident, kind of like sometimes the Jayhawks do in basketball, and then they get beat because they've got two I'm a Jayhawks fan. That's my daughter and son-in-law graduated from KU. So, you know, when a team gets too cocky and self-confident, then they're setting themselves up for a fall, right? Okay, that's what they did. They used the Ark of the Covenant. Well, they're all boastful, and they head into battle with the Ark of the Covenant, and the Philistines win and capture the Ark of the Covenant. Well, now what are we going to do? And what are the Philistines going to do? All of a sudden, the Philistines start having problems because the Ark of the Covenant is now in the enemy camp. Their god, the statue of their god Dagon, all of a sudden mysteriously falls over. Its head's knocked off. Its arms are knocked off, and it's lying face down. And then they all start breaking out with cancerous tumors. And they say, what the heck have we done? Let's give the Ark back. Interesting stories. And so they give the Ark back. When the Israelites were defeated, Eli's grandson is born, and he names him Ichabod, which means, do you remember Moses' mother's name? Jochebed, Ichabod. This means Yahweh is glory. This means there is no glory. Your names are so interesting to me. The legend of Sleepy Hollow, Ichabod Crane. There is no glory, Crane. Yeah, names are very interesting, and they have make symbolic meaning. So Eli's grandson is named Ichabod because they lost the battle. The Ark of the Covenant has been taken captive, and so the grandson is named Ichabod. And has to grow up with that name, I guess. Then after the Ark is brought back to the Israelites, and they celebrate its return, and Samuel brings all the people together at Mizpah. You remember Mizpah? It's all these, you know, there's all these threads that connect through. You get places. It's not just that they're revisiting the same places, but there's symbolic meaning in them. Mizpah was where Jacob and Laban reconciled after they had been cut off from each other. And they set up a heap of stones, and the blessing was given, may the Lord watch between you and me while we're absent from one another. And the name Mizpah means watch post. Back at Mizpah, which is now one of the key worship sites, Samuel calls the tribes together to celebrate the return of the ark, and he does a little kind of covenant renewal. Remember the covenant. We have to be obedient to God, or we're going to fall into disaster like just happened when the ark was taken, and now the ark's back. Remember the covenant. He doesn't go through a whole big covenant renewal ceremony, but kind of like Joshua, Samuel is reminding people, we can't go after foreign gods. We can't just get all cocky and haughty and think it's all our ability and we've got this magic ark. No, it's all about being faithful to Yahweh's covenant. So kind of a covenant renewal there at Mizpah. And the Philistines, like, oops, the tribes are all together. Maybe now's the time we can defeat them. And so the Philistines come bursting in to try to take over the people. And they are fought off, the Amalekites, and what was it? Oh, that's where, the important part of that story, Samuel wins the victory and he sets up a stone. Again, the importance of teaching, the importance of memorials, the importance of remembering the covenant. And he names the stone what? It's in our hymn that we played. Guide me, O thou great Jehovah. What's the second verse? Here I raise mine Ebenezer, hither by thy help I'm come. Ebenezer means stone of help. Ebenezer. Ezer is help. The name, you see that later, Eleazar is God, God is our help. the name Eleazar means God is our help. Ebenezer, stone of help. God has been with us and given us the victory. And so we're going to set up a stone, just like the stones, the heap of stones at Mizpah, where they've gathered back together right before this battle by Samuel. Just like the stones at the River Jordan, the 12 stones in the circle at Gilgal. Now another stone, Ebenezer. Remember, God is our help. We need to be true to God's covenant. And then, I've got us up to the kings. Thank goodness. we have this story in Samuel, 1 Samuel chapter 8. About the clamor for a king. Because Samuel's two sons, Samuel has gotten old now, and Samuel's two sons ain't as good as Samuel. back in the story of the call of Samuel, Eli the priest, his two sons who were going to carry on the priesthood, they were corrupt. They were sleeping with prostitutes, with temple prostitutes for the other gods. They were skimming off the part of the sacrifice that was supposed to be sacrificed for Yahweh, and they were taking it for themselves. They were corrupt. And so there's a whole story about that and about the judgment that comes to Eli's sons. And now Samuel, the great prophet, his sons are corrupt. And so the people get worried again, and they say, we need a king. We've been being led by judges, and we're worried about the Philistines coming back. We need a king to lead us instead of Eli's corrupt sons who are taking bribes and doing all kinds of things. And so here we're going to end with this. They rang that early. It's not. We've got 2 minutes left. chapter 8, and that's good because it gets us to kings, which is where we need to be. Then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah and said to him, you are old, and your sons do not follow your ways. Appoint for us then a king to govern us like other nations. So it's very key. Instead of themselves being a light to the nations, now they want to be like the other nations. Instead of following God as their king, Yahweh as their king, they want to have their own human king who they think can rescue them. So that's very important distinction there. But the thing displeased Samuel when they said, give us a king to govern us. Samuel prayed to the Lord, and the Lord said to Samuel, listen to the voice of the people and all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them. Just as they have done to me from the day I brought them up out of Egypt to this day, forsaking me and serving other gods, so also they are doing to you. Now then, if that's what they want, well, give it to them and see what happens to them. Now then, listen to their voice. Only you shall solemnly warn them and show them the ways of the king who shall reign over them. So Samuel reported all the words of the Lord to the people who were asking him for a king. He said, these will be the ways of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them to his chariots and to be his horsemen and to run before his chariots. So there's going to be a draft, conscription, forced conscription. And he will appoint for himself commanders of thousands and commanders of fifties, and some to plow his ground and to reap his harvest and to make his implements of war and the equipment for his chariots. So there's going to be a military agricultural complex. Not military industrial, but so now all of the agriculture is also going to get funneled toward the desires of the king for an army and for war. He will take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers. He will take the best of your fields and vineyards and olive orchards and give them to his courtiers. So again, this military agricultural complex. And now the conscription of women too, to be almost like slaves for the king. He will take one-tenth of your grain and of your vineyards and give it to his officers and his courtiers, a tax. It'll be taxes. He will take your male and female slaves and the best of your cattle and your donkeys and put them to his work. He will take one-tenth of your flocks, and you shall be his slaves. So it's like they're going back. The king's going to put you back into slavery, just like slavery in Pharaoh's time. And in that day you will cry out because of your king, whom you have chosen for yourselves, but the Lord will not answer you in that day. So you're going to get your just desserts. You're going to get, be careful what you pray for, because you may just get it, and then you find out it's not all it's cracked up to be. But the people refused to listen to the voice of Samuel. They said, no, we want Donald Trump. I didn't say that. No, but we are determined to have a king over us, so that we also may be like other nations, and that so that we may be like other nations. So that we may be like other nations. That's important. And that our king may govern us and go out before us and fight our battles. When Samuel had heard all the words of the people, he repeated them in the ears of the Lord. The Lord said to Samuel, listen to their voice and set a king over them. Samuel then said to the people of Israel, each of you return home. So, you have this ambiguous situation of the people wanting a king. Yahweh is the true king. And yet God gives them a king. And these are going to be the results. And we'll pick up next week with the wonderful history of the kings and what they did in Israel. Thank you.
It was very intentional. Yeah, I mean, that's the scary thing about Trump is that all of the stuff he wants to do is all very autocratic. I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. Oh, I brought copies of Martin Luther King Jr.'s sermon, The Death of Evil on the Seashore, which I mentioned last week as we finished up the Exodus, and it's a great sermon. I made 20 copies of it if you're interested in it. It's a great sermon, and it impresses me that his biblical scholarship, it's not just rhetorically great. I mean, he's got really good biblical scholarship. So if you'd like a copy of that, they're here.